Welcome to the Model Railroader, your ultimate destination for all things railroading. From trains.com, we bring you step-by-step modeling and construction projects, insightful reviews, tips from the experts, and more. This program is proudly presented by Aftersight, a community hub for audio news, entertainment, and resources. Find us at aftersight.org. This program is intended to be used solely by individuals who are blind or have low vision. All aboard!
Thank you for joining us for the Model Railroader magazine, read by Jason Consul. Today, we will be reading the following articles: Putting the Track in T-Track, Narrow Gauge in the Centennial State, and On Operation. The first article is a continuation from last week, Putting the Track in T-Track. One of the neat features of T-Track is that the standards on ntrak.org give you a complete list of kata unit track needed for each module. The single straight modules use two each of 20-010 or 7 5/16 inch straight and 20-020 or 4 7/8 inch straight sections. The double straight requires fewer pieces if you use 4 20-000 or 9 3/4 inch straight and 2 20-020. We both have modules with spurs and industries on them, so we used Kato 20-220 number 4 turnouts in the double modules. The recommended practice is to use number 6 turnouts for passing sidings and crossovers, but ours are switching spurs, so the number 4 turnouts worked better here. T-Track requires that you modify the Kato number 4 turnout slightly by filing away a bit of the head and base of the rail, allowing the points to seat flush. After marking the ends of the switch points on the stock rails with a felt-tipped pen, David carefully pulled the rails partway out of the plastic roadbed and filed notches in the rails. Check your work carefully. After filing, he used needle-nose pliers to guide the rails back into position. Only use a pulling motion. If they're pushed, the rails may buckle where the notches were filed. The end result sees the point rails sitting in the notch where they won't catch wheel flanges and cause derailments. See Figure 1, previous page. The RS Laser Kit modules include mounting tabs for attaching the plastic track sections to the plywood benchwork. The kit includes a wood sheet of oval tabs that need to be popped out. Wood glue is used to bond the tabs together in pairs. We flipped a section of track over, applied DAP latex caulk around the mounting posts, and pressed the tabs in place. Let the caulk set overnight before applying the track to the module. T-Track recommends feeder wires on all straight module sections. The curved sections are larger and fit tightly together, leaving little space to run feeder wires. To remedy this, we used tweezer nose pliers to remove the stock rail joiners. We replaced the Kato 24-818 terminal unit joiners. T-Track standards are to wire the feeders for the two main lines with opposite polarity. As long as you install the terminal unit joiners with the blue wire on the outer rail of each main, you will have the polarity correct per standards, see Figure 2. Then we slipped the plugs and leads through the pre-cut holes in the deck of the modules. We applied wood glue to the tabs and positioned the track on the modules. Our kits came with a pair of alignment guides for the ends, see Figure 3, as well as scribed lines on the deck, making it easy to get everything to fit properly. We had to ensure that the unit track was even at the ends and overhung the module by at least 1 millimeter. Otherwise, it would be difficult to join and separate the modules. While wood glue works for the tabs under the track, we used caulk on the bottom of the turnouts as they're sealed on the bottom. We also noticed that after connecting the modules and taking them apart again, that the track started to come loose. The solution? Nailing blocks at the ends. David cut 1x2 into 3-inch lengths so that each module could have blocks glued under both ends, see Figure 4. From there, we measured the location of the nailing post on a spare piece of track and drilled openings on the track sections already glued to the modules. Then we installed Atlas ATL2540 track nails with a hammer and a nail set. Problem solved. Wiring. Unlike a home layout, where you can wire things any way you want, if you want to use your T-Track modules with a club, you need to follow the rules. So we did exactly that. You can find the T-Track standards PDF, including wiring instructions, on ntrak.org. As noted earlier, we attached the blue wire to the outside rail on both lines, with white wires on the two inner rails. Because of its portability, the DCC power bus must be completely independent of the layout. To make the bus, we needed Kato three-way sockets, (24-827), 12-gauge stranded wire, and color-coded Anderson Power Products power pole 30-amp connectors. The bus is made by attaching the 30-amp connectors to each end and allowing it to connect to any other T-Track power bus of the same colors. The simplest bus to build is with blue and white wires, which is used on layouts with a single bus powering both main lines. T-Track Standard 6.2.3 explains the correct orientation for the power pole connectors for each end of the different types of buses in order to prevent accidentally crossing polarity when assembling a T-Track layout. We used a special crimper that works with the 30-amp Anderson power pole connectors, see Figure 2, previous page. The plastic sockets have locking tabs and grooves on the side and can be joined with each other in a number of combinations. For our application, the white socket was placed over the top of the blue socket. While David was crimping, he used a short piece of 16-gauge blue and white wire to make a connector for our NCE power cab DCC system. On one end, he placed power pole connectors that plug into the track bus. On the other end, he installed a black screw terminal that plugs into the DCC system, see Figure 3. The brand of DCC system is up to you. We used an NCE system, but by using a jumper like this, you can plug it into any DCC system you wish. Since we built our T-Track modules with two main lines, David installed Kato extension cables every 2 feet, pairing up to a Kato three-way socket and a 24-825 extension cord, giving him the needed 4 sockets per installation. For solder-free connections, David used brown Scotch-Lock insulation displacement connectors, or IDCs, to attach to the 12-gauge bus wire. However, the wire on the Kato power extensions is 20-gauge, which is too small to use with a connector. He had to place 16-gauge pigtail wires between the bus and the sockets, making the connection with smaller red Scotch-Lock IDCs, see Figure 4. To use the bus, we laid it out behind the modules and plugged the feeder wires into the nearest port, see Figure 5. Then the DCC system jumper was connected between the system and the bus. Why did we use an NCE power cab system? We liked how the power cab system could be installed using a simple plug port as the base station. David reinforced the thin plywood used on the modules that hold the DCC cab plug ports with a small piece of half-inch plywood. He then cut an opening for the NCE panel and installed it with half-inch screws, see Figure 6. The reinforced front is very strong, meaning the screws won't pull out of the module over time, see Figure 7. Now we can run some trains. Be sure to check back next month for the finale of our 2025 project layout series. We'll show you how we turned these flat pieces of plywood into the Colorado Plains. The next article is Narrow Gauge in the Centennial State. This SN3 Rio Grande Southern layout is set in the 1930s. By Ted Van Pelt, photos by Lou Sassy. Like many model railroaders, my hobby journey started at a young age. When I was around 4 or 5, I was given an American Flyer 3-rail O-gauge train set. For Christmas, I asked for additional track and cars. Today, I model the Rio Grande Southern during the 1930s in SN3. So, how did a native of the Missouri Ozarks wind up modeling one of Colorado's popular narrow-gauge lines while living in Florida? It was a long, winding journey. I grew up in Salem, Missouri, at the end of a St. Louis-San Francisco, or Frisco Railway, branch line with a roundhouse and locomotive servicing facilities. My maternal great-grandfather worked on the Frisco for a while, as did his son, my grandfather. As a small boy, he took me to the roundhouse numerous times to visit his old friends. Relations on my maternal grandmother's side of the family also had various ties to railroading, including re-railing derailed cars and helping with construction of the new station in Louisville, Kentucky. After I married my high school sweetheart, Joyce, we spent a year away from home to start our life together. We wound up in Telluride, Colorado, and then Pueblo. There, she gifted me my first kit, a silver streak caboose, then three model die-casting ore cars. Making many switches. We later returned to Salem, where I built a 5x9-foot HO scale layout in a garage. We then moved to another house, this one without a garage. There, I constructed a small layout in our bedroom. However, modeling Ozark railroading left me wanting more in terms of scenery. Remembering Colorado's narrow-gauge lines and the beautiful scenery around them, I added a narrow-gauge section to the layout. Later, after moving to a house in Florida with a one-car garage to fill, I built an HO and HON3 layout with some dual-gauge track. When we moved to a larger house in Florida with a two-car garage that my wife let me have for a model railroad, I built the SN3 layout shown here. I picked a larger scale because my eyesight was failing. Little did I know that switching to SN3 just added more tiny detail. Developing a plan. My goal was to build an operating layout that took two or three people to run. Since I was the only SN3 modeler within 60 miles, this never happened. I worked from a very loose track plan that I'd drawn up, making my curves broad enough that a P-B-L SN3 Denver and Rio Grande Western class K-37282 could comfortably negotiate them. As with my previous dual-gauge layout, I used open-grid benchwork on the SN3 model railroad. I cut the plywood for the subroad bed with a bandsaw. Then I cut homosote for the roadbed, gluing it to the plywood. Originally, I used Commercial Code 70 flex track and number 6 turnouts. Then, after watching K-27 steam locomotives clunk through the turnouts, I slowly started replacing them with handmade turnouts built in place. Later, I purchased a Fast Tracks turnout assembly fixture. I discovered a few more missteps along the way. First, I didn't have enough sidings. When I added more, I switched to Code 55 track. This proved a big mistake as the smaller rail was harder to work with. On previous layouts, I used solenoid or snap turnout motors. They soon began to fail on the SN3 layout, so I switched to Tortoise by Circuitron slow motion switch machines. This is a decision I've never regretted. The first time I needed a three-way turnout, I couldn't find one that appealed to me, so I placed two regular turnouts close together in my first yard. However, this took up too much space. When I started my second and third yards, friend Greg Bedleck designed space-efficient three-way stub switches. They've worked perfectly for years. Mountain scenery. Modeling the Rio Grande Southern meant I needed mountain scenery and lots of trees. I shaped the mountains with small chicken wire form. Then I covered the forms with paper bags soaked in hydrocal. The outcroppings were made using molding plaster and latex molds. I made some of the molds, others were commercial offerings. When I first made pine trees, I used the old method of carving a trunk, adding pieces of filter material for the limbs, spraying them with hairspray, and applying ground foam. I only recently replaced the last of those trees with ones made from hemp rope and wire. A friend in Tampa, Florida taught me how to make oak trees using a piece of rope. Scenic Express Super Tree material, fine green grass, hairspray, and superglue. It takes several hours to make one of these trees, but they do look good. Colorado has a lot of retaining walls. I noticed that the logs take on the color of the rocks and dirt behind them. Wanting to add some of these signature walls to my layout, I made 3 different latex molds. Then I used HydroCal to make the castings. Once HydroCal had cured, I removed the castings from the molds and cut them to the appropriate size for each scene. Then I applied paint washes matched to the color of the dirt around them to the castings. I used dirt from prototype locations for scenery, as do some others who model Colorado's narrow gauge lines. I joke that the Colorado mountains are several feet lower than they were before model railroaders started taking sacks of dirt every time they visited. When creating a scene, I first get a picture of what I want in my mind. For instance, I had a spot where I wanted to add a waterfall. Editor's note, see photo on page 37. I worked around it for years until one of my best friends, John Addison, asked me if I wanted him to build it. He is a genius with modeling water, so naturally I said yes. We used a tag team approach on this project. I added the rocks and dirt around the scene while John worked on the water using liquid plastic and fish tank filter material. When the scene was completed, it was exactly like I'd envisioned. I added fishermen to the scene, now a focal point on the layout. Scratch-built structures. Over the years, I collected many S-scale structures. When I started to assemble the kits, I found that I didn't want my model railroad to have the same buildings found on other layouts. That led me to scratch-built structures from photos we'd taken during our many trips to Colorado. Having 4 children and 8 grandchildren to take to Disney World, I noticed that the buildings there are about 80%, but no one ever noticed. I figured if Disney could get away with it, so could I. The exceptions are the structures that I built from Mike Blazek plans. If you're going to model Western narrow gauge railroads and enjoy scratch building, his plans are a must. The depot at Vance Junction, shown at lower left, was one of my first scratch build depots. The prototype was designed but never built because of the 1893 silver panic. The building was perfect for the space I had. I used cedar cigar wrappers cut to the appropriate size for shingles. I normally don't keep track of time when working on models, but this time I did. Even with a jig, it took 8 hours to cut the shingles. I glued them onto the roof while watching television with Joyce. That took another 60 hours. She suggested that I use laser-cut shingle strips for future products. I turned to molding plaster for the roundhouse and 2-stall engine house. I started by purchasing molded brick and stone castings and making latex molds of them. Then I cut plastic blanks to the size of the commercial window castings I was going to install, placed them in the proper position, and poured molding plaster around them. When cured the next day, I knocked the plastic blanks out and finished the openings with a file. I carefully painted the bricks and stones in a variety of colors. Then I glued the walls together, built the roof, added the smokestacks, and installed the window castings. Before placing the structures on the layout, I cut inspection pits in the homasote and covered the floors with planks. I later added interior lighting. Since I'm modeling the steam era, I lightly airbrushed the tops of the door openings with black paint to represent soot stains. Beyond the layout. The photo backdrops were made from images I took during trips to Colorado. The first one we worked on showed the Silver Plume area. It took me 2 trips to Colorado to get the lighting right. Fortunately, we have an information technology man at the office who edited and stitched the various photos together. It was printed out and laminated with a dulling material. By the time the backdrop was finished, I was bemoaning the fact it cost so much. My youngest son, then in his 30s, asked me how many PBL engines I had and how many of them were in boxes on the shelf. Then he pointed out that every time I went into the train room, I enjoyed the photo backdrops and that many of the engines I only took out a couple of times a year. No wonder he is now the president of our family business. With all 4 walls covered with photo backdrops, the first thing 95% of the people entering the layout room say is, "Wow." It took 3 visits to Colorado and several trips to Saw Pit each time to get the necessary images. The effort was worth it. Into the future. The majority of the locomotives on the layout are PBL, with a few others that I've collected over the past 45 years. Most of the freight cars are PBL kits. I also have a string of VNT shops drop bottom gondolas and a lot of the company's open and closed passenger cars with PBL trucks and Richardson lights. Recently, I scratch-built 2 truss rod flat cars using lengths of 2x8 strip wood for the deck. After assembly, I wound up with 2 extra planks. Though my skills have slipped over the past few years, along with my eyesight and hearing, I still love the hobby and visiting with other modelers. Meet Ted Van Pelt. Ted Van Pelt and his wife Joyce worked in the printing trade until 1978 when they started manufacturing printing equipment. The couple worked together at the office and at home, raising 4 children. They also hosted 8 exchange students. Joyce passed away on February 2, 2022, 3 days after their 73rd anniversary. The next article is On Operation by Jerry Dietzick. Winter Reading. Dark winter days give strong appeal to curling up by the fire in a comfortable chair with a good book. Here are 4 titles, thick with interesting prototype material, which threw themselves at my reading list. Fred Gamst is a railroader turned anthropologist who is highly regarded for his studies of railroad operations. I mentioned his monograph, Highballing with Flimsies, and January 2001's Reading Rooms and Rattlesnakes. Highballing is a railroader's account of timetable and train order operation, or TTTO, on the Southern Pacific. It makes enjoyable reading, even rereading, because it describes his research on SP during its transition from TTTO to direct traffic control between 1978 and 1988. Several issues of The Dispatcher's Office, the Operations Special Interest Group's quarterly, carried a condensed version in 2002 and 2003. The National Transportation Library's website has the complete, unabridged text. Gamst's railroad experience also animates his The Hoghead, Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, 1980. It describes working a tonnage drag so vividly one can almost feel how an engineer feels train handling, adjusting slack with the throttle and brakes through the seat of the pants. Gamst acknowledges that actual prototype practice sometimes bends the rules. Quote, "Turn off that bell, will ya?" end quote, rings true, doesn't it? He also reflects on the demanding world of a railroader whose family, quote, "consists of a husband, a wife, several children, and a telephone," end quote. Internet auction sites turn up copies of Hogshead readily. Benjamin Schwant's The Train and the Telegraph, John Hopkins Press, 2019, challenges the conventional wisdom that railroading and telegraphy were natural partners, paralleling each other's technological development. He describes how early telegraph unreliability troubled railroads, later competing for priority over the wires, first with military dispatches during the Civil War, and then with commercial messages, reinforced railroads' reluctance to rely on telegraphic train orders. Ironically, telegraphic dispatching was still being debated in 1879 when telephone dispatching first took place. One passage startled me because it undermines credit given to Charles Minot for the first train order in 1851. Schwantz describes how riots in Philadelphia in 1844 had its mayor send a request for federal aid by express train. When it arrived in Baltimore, B&O President Lewis McLean telegraphed an order to Washington to hold a northbound train to expedite the report to the Capitol on the southbound. Schwantz's thorough research makes him persuasive. Our favorite O&W stories is the Ontario and Western Railway Historical Society's latest. The New York, Ontario, and Western was a beloved anthracite road, the first Class 1 abandonment when it gave up in 1957. Stories, however, serves universal appeal in its family-style helpings of how much small-town flavor railroading delivered. Three writers contributed, each of whom recite hand-me-down history they collected from O&W veterans and neighbors. The railroad followed such a tortuous route that its profile looks like a two-man cross-cut saw blade. Quote, making the grade is an enlightening discussion of using adjusted tonnage ratings to assign power. Enjoy the Fagan family of engineers. Seven members of the extended Fagans served as O&W engineers between 1876 and 1956. An astonishing collection of memorabilia remains in the family, making the story read like thumbing through an heirloom photo album. Another is Accord agent Mike Palmer, who started his O&W career in 1907 as a 17-year-old. Like so many then, he fell under the tutelage of his hometown agent, learned telegraphy, and earned a job on the agent's recommendation. The story rests on an interview Mike gave in 1973, so it's a first-hand recollection of laboring over an Oliver No. 9 typewriter to handle rural traffic and dairy products, Sears Roebuck, and hundreds of crates of eggs on express wagons. Who could help wondering how many hens were behind this? By the way, pronounce accord with an accent on the first syllable, accord. Stories is well illustrated with railroaders at work, their mementos, such as uniform caps and brotherhood buttons, neighbors who waved at passing trains, and compelling small-town scenes that beg modeling. To order a copy of Stories, visit the Society's webpage at ontarioexpress.org/sales-table. When it arrives, settle down with a warming beverage and discover that beaver-killed trout are too big for the creel. Thank you for joining us for The Model Railroader, read by Jason Consul.
You've been listening to The Model Railroader, brought to you by Trains.com. That's TRANES.com, in collaboration with AfterSight. If you've enjoyed this episode, we invite you to visit our website at AfterSight.org for more audio editions and original podcasts. For additional inquiries or to contact us, call us at 303-786-7777. Or email contact@aftersight.org. Thank you for listening.